Simon Spruill switches to Tesla, GM's ignition switches turn off the public, and do you want high tech or horsepower?
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 233 for March 14th. Chuck Thomas, Honda's Cap'n Crunch. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Terry Vasilak, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good, John. How are you?
I'm doing well, and we'll be joined momentarily, we're told, by Brent Snavely from the Free Press, and fill us in on what he's been doing on. But you've been out driving Audis this week,
right? Yeah, I
was
just out driving the A3 sedan. That's the proper name of this car because there is the A3 Sportback, which will eventually get here because you remember that the A3 used to be the hatchback in the U.S. market and probably wasn't doing so well. So this is the first car that Audi has specifically designed for the American market. And the designer, Danny Garan, made it very clear that he wanted to make this a three-box design, a classic sedan. He wasn't taking the Sportback and sticking a trunk on the back. He wanted to make sure that this was the kind of cars that Americans look for.
And what's your verdict? And from the looks, we'll get into the rest in a minute, but
I think he did a very nice job with that car. I mean, it looks sufficiently Audi.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done a fantastic job on stamping the sheet metal panels. I mean, there are some creases in that. And I was asking him. I said, "Come on, you gotta tell me that when you went to the press room that these guys said that you're just absolutely crazy. You can't do this." And he said, "Well, at first they were a little hesitant about the whole thing." He said, "But we worked it out." And he says, "Because when we were designing it, you know, we wanted the radiuses to be as tight as we could possibly get them." And they just did a great job on that. It's just quite amazing. And, you know, Audi is making a big investment because they're actually building this car in a plant in Hungary. That's the plant where the TT originally came from. And, they spent 900 million euro in developing a whole facility that will be making these A3s as well as some other vehicles.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, a lot of interesting technology that they put in there, laser welding for the roof and so on. And I think they did a really nice job. And but what I think is somewhat fascinating, you know, you were mentioning in the lead-in about getting this on Bluetooth in your car for the show, that when they were unveiling the car to the press, it was almost like a trade show, whereby there were booths from Google, in NVIDIA, in Qualcomm, in AT&T,
they brought in all the suppliers.
They brought in all the tech suppliers, and Scott Keogh, who's the president of Audi, said
USA.
Out of USA, he said, "These are tech partners. They're not tech suppliers because usually when somebody from my side of the world, the OEM side of the world, says suppliers, he means getting something at the lowest possible price." He says, "We don't look at it that way. You know, these are our partners in developing this technology." And so, you know, this car, which begins at just under $30,000, is, you know, meant to be an entry into the Audi brand. So presumably this means younger buyers who will be more tech savvy and be more interested in getting, you know, high levels of technology.
So, and Audi's now first to market with 4G LTE technology.
That's right. Yeah.
GM thought they were going to be the first ones to market.
I don't think that GM ever thought they were going to be first to market. But what GM is saying is that we are going to put this across our lineup
in everything.
In everything. My understanding is the only everything that they're not putting it in initially, at least, is the Cruise, because I think that that's about to be changed. And I would suspect that you'd have some issues in terms of wiring harnesses or whatnot in order to, you know, embed the new electronics necessary to do that. So GM will be widest, but Audi is first with this, with the Ford LTE in it. And so their partner, AT&T, moved away from T-Mobile, which had, you know, been another supplier for them. And so it's an interesting car. I mean, it's because if you think about it, in Europe, there's an A1.
Hey, Brent Snavely's here. So you're keeping the tradition of us having other people come on the show who take their own leisurely time showing up.
Well, sorry about the delay.
Good to have you here, though.
Heavier traffic than expected.
Yeah.
Apologize for that.
Yeah, don't worry about it. No, it's good to have you here.
It's all that ice from the Polar Vortex Mark 8 or whatever it is.
There we go. Sure.
Gary's just filling me in. He was driving the A3 sedan from Audi earlier this week, right? Or was that last week?
That was this week, yeah.
Okay. Last week was the big GM SUVs.
That was
right?
A week before that.
A week before that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I like those. I like
those. There's a lot to like in those cars, but...
Have you been in those, Brent?
I have not.
Yeah.
I have not.
What I think is significant about the big GM SUVs is these are the first full-size SUVs I'm aware of to get this magnetic rheological shock technology. Mm-hmm. And at least with the 20-inch wheels, it's magic. Once you go up to the 22s, which I drove in a Yukon XL Denali, the ride was not quite as good, and the GM guys did say, yeah, they're still tweaking the calibration mm-hmm. of it. But on the 20-inch wheels on the Suburban that I drove, the ride is surprisingly good for such a big body-on-frame mm-hmm. SUV.
But again, truth be told, the roads we were driving on were not exactly...
Well, they're not Michigan.
They're not exactly like our roads by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
And so,
that's right.
So you could have basically been driving a go-kart, and you thought, man, this is really nice suspension setup.
Yeah.
I mean, that is using that architecture that was developed that's being used for the new pickup trucks, the new full-size pickup trucks that GM has. So it goes back to the 2011 redevelopment of those pickups, and but it's all new sheet metal.
It works. Unlike the Silverado, which is, to my eye at least, very difficult to discern from the prior model, the new Suburban, Tahoe, Yukon, boy, you know them instantly.
Right.
And it's not like they're radically different. But mm-hmm. You know instantly that's the new one.
Yeah, and the Denali is really a nice vehicle. I mean,
it is.
And what was interesting is that so there's a 6.2 liter engine
only in the Denali.
Only in the Denali, and I was like, when I was looking at my notes, like, there's got to be something wrong here. You know, the Chevy has to have one. There's something wrong here. And so I contacted them. They said, no, it's just yeah. a Denali.
Yeah. And that's how you charge. You can probably price a Denali up close to $80,000 now. So you're definitely into Range Rover territory.
We were in a Chevy that was at 72.
So it'd be
very easy to walk up to that mm-hmm. price point.
And again, if you're going to charge that kind of money, you got to be able to tell them there's something unique about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, so you're the only ones with a giant V8 in it. But
I think the exterior design of that car, I mean, the three-dimensionality of the grill on that thing, it's just one of those things where you look around and you just find these little...
It looks fabricated, not molded.
Right, right. It did a good job on that.
But speaking of GM, I know, Brent, I'm sure you've been all over covering this ignition switch fiasco that's blown up in their face. What do you make of that? What do you make of how they're handling it?
It seems to be, dribbling out, frankly. I mean, I was thinking a few weeks ago when they first expanded it to doubling the size of it, they really didn't provide a lot of info to consumers. And, you know, there was no, my editors wanted to know what phone number can we put in the story for readers to call. Well, GM didn't provide a phone number that day, you know, and now they're doing everything up to offering this $500 rebate and loaner cars, and you know, so it seems like at first it was slow, and then now they're just kind of catching up. It's a little.
What do you make, Gary? How do you think they're handling?
Well, I mean, It's a little surprising. I mean, that, you know, and as he uses the word, you know, it's this like dribbling out, and it isn't all you know being revealed. And when I was reading the information about the $500, so it's to lease or buy a new car. And now, are they suggesting that dealers provide a loaner car, or are they telling dealers that they provide a loaner car? And then I read something that it takes like 5 minutes to fix. And I mean,
right,
it's why would you have a loaner car if you could just get it? You know,
I think it's there for customers that want it. I don't think they're pushing it, but it's there if customers are uncomfortable. And here's the issue. The dealers don't have the parts yet. The ignition switches aren't getting to dealers until early April. So the loaner car is there for those that are scared to death to drive it between now and the time that the dealers get the ignition switches. And I think that's another question, too, is I don't think that, you know, every dealer in the country is going to have adequate supply of ignition switches on April 1st. It's going to take a little while.
Dribble out like
yes.
The news.
And there's another end. And, you know, I don't know who we now know who made the initial ignition switches. I'm wondering who's making the replacement ignition switches and what factory is churning out, you know, a couple hundred thousand
but
replacement
isn't it
switches.
Just the spring within the ignition switch.
Yeah.
I don't profess to know, you know, all this in detail, but my understanding is they have too soft of a detent spring, so this thing can
yes.
be knocked in, you know, knocked off, mm-hmm. not in the running position, and that the real fix within the ignition switch is just a tougher spring.
Yeah, that I'm not sure about. That yeah. I'm not sure about.
Whatever the fix may be, yeah. And yeah. My understanding is it's not that expensive to do. It's like a $50 per job, you know, at the dealership, $50 per job.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there will be a whole lot of people who have these vehicles that are going to take advantage of this $500?
I don't know.
What do you think of it?
My phone is ringing off the hook with people that want information, that want to know who to call to get more info, is their car covered, all kinds of questions. I mean, the same thing happened last year with, and here's where I kind of urge some caution. I mean, I was going through this last year with the Jeep Cherokee recall with the, you know, exploding rear gas tanks and the, you know, and the trailer hook fix that Chrysler came up with. And we were writing the similar kinds of stories of, will this damage their reputation? Will this, you
but
know,
this new
but,
recall
but a year
totally
later,
different, you know, nature. I mean, the rear gas tank thing in the Jeep, yeah, it was a fluke accident kind of occurrence that it might happen.
Right.
And a bumper hitch is kind of a, I can't believe they got away with that.
I know.
But, you know, it sort of does mitigate the problem, whereas I'm astonished to learn, because I haven't heard of this ignition switch problem. I've driven all the vehicles involved in it. I never had this incident happen to me at all. So, I mean, and yet, it's not at all uncommon. There's a dozen or more deaths attributed to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to me, even though you were writing the same kind of stories a year ago, this is a different story.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. One of our people in the chat room, JNM1NB, wants to know what's worse, the ignition issue or how it took a decade for them to admit it.
Right.
Well, that's
right.
The problem.
Right.
You know, defects happen. Car companies do the best job they possibly can, but, you know, every now and then something slips through.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the damage, is why did they know about it a year ago? Why was a design change done but not approved?
Mm-hmm.
Why did a design change happen, and now they say they don't know how it happened? Have that right?
Yeah, I mean, and the letter that GM sent to NHTSA that we got yesterday is really kind of weird and revealing. I mean, it says they knew about this in 2005 and issued an advisory to dealers, you know, to why they didn't take more action at the time is beyond me. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting. You know, you're talking about you didn't have the experience. One of our colleagues, Jeff Sabatini, who works at Car and Driver,
did have it.
He was reviewing for the New York Times at the time, back in 2005, and was a Cobalt, and his wife had the car, and she experienced the problem.
Right.
And you know, he sent me a link to his story, and so there's the review, and then there's a box
Wow.
And it's right there, you know, in the story. But, and this is 2005.
Yeah, and that's what everybody is saying now. How could GM management not know about it when there was a New York Times story about it?
Right.
And there was a public relations response to that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's...
I wonder if the letter that I read, the GM letter to NHTSA, referenced three stories, a New York Times story, a Cleveland Plain Dealer story,
right.
And a smaller local Ohio, like Sandusky, Ohio story or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if, I mean, they didn't cite the headline or the date of these stories. They just referenced the papers
from
2005. So I'm wondering if it was that story.
Could have been.
Let's do a quick poll with the chat room. So everybody who's watching live right now, we want you to rate GM's management in its handling of this crisis. And remember, the people who are running the show right now are not the people who made this decision, or so we don't think. We don't know that for a fact yet, do we? But we'll find out. So the poll for the chat room, rate it on a 1 to 5 scale, with 1 being the worst, 5 being the best. How would you rate GM's management? And we'll get the results of that
in a little while. And on this topic, Schmetzel wants to know, why didn't NHTSA let GM get away with this? Didn't NHTSA let them get away with it?
You could argue that, and lawyers are arguing that.
When did the fatalities start to happen in this? I mean, there's a dozen or so fatalities. Do we know when the first one occurred?
I think there's one from 2008, and then there's one from 2010. I mean, some are after...
With the first and definitely the second, that's when all the alarm bells should have been running and saying, you know, this is no longer just a debate over spring rates or whatever within an ignition lock. We got to act now. I mean, that's where, to me, something broke down real bad that they didn't act at that point.
But is GM management sufficiently in the forefront on this? I mean, do you get this? I mean, you're talking to them all the time. I mean, do you get the sense that they're proactively trying to solve this? I mean, I think back to the days when there was Saturn and there'd be any little problem and, you know, the guys at Saturn would be, you know, falling on their swords and cooking hot dogs, you know. I mean, just whatever it took to keep the customers happy. And I mean, from the reporting that I'm reading about this, I mean, I'm not getting that sense that that there's a whole lot of activity that's proactive.
I mean, they're trying to say that they are. Mary Barra issued a letter to employees that GM posted on one of its sites, you know, saying they're doing, this is the new GM, they're being proactive. They've got basically an internal, they hired an outside law firm to do an investigate their own investigation. I don't know. So they're on it. They're taking steps, but is it enough? And we'll see. And April 3rd is going to be a really interesting day. That's when GM's response to NHTSA with like 103 questions or something like
107.
That is 107 is due to be turned in. We'll all be trying to get a hold of that and sort through those answers. That'll be a fun day.
Yeah, I was very surprised. I mean, to go to the NHTSA website and see all 107 questions were there. I mean, that you could read them.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, some of them very engineering related, but many of them very much related to, you know, the classic, you know, when did you know and or when did you know it
yeah,
or
what did you know? What did you know and when did you know it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Going back to Watergate, yeah, some people are already calling this Switchgate. Yeah, where it is.
Everything has to have a name.
But here's the other, I think, critical question as far as their public image goes. Do they just go, hey, that was liquidation motors, baby. That's the old GM. We don't owe nobody a dime.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be, even if it would be totally legal for them to do, it'd be disaster. Of course, they'd pretty it up in the way they said it, not like I just did.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't believe, just from a public relations standpoint, that they cannot, the new GM has got to accept total blame for this and liability.
Yeah.
That's how
They will take a public relations pounding if they do that. But you can just see the lawyers, I mean, I can just hear the legal arguments going, wait, whoa, I mean... This, if we open this, you don't know what's down the road. What other, you then set a precedent that just erases the entire liability agreement from 2009.
It does, but I think a good precedent is what Toyota went through with the whole so-called unintended acceleration. You know, I don't know what the final bill on that was.
It must be a big bill, but I mean, I think there's a difference here is that basically Toyota was saying that that was not a problem. I mean, this was not...
No, it was the same issue. They were not reacting to it. They were brushing it under the rug. You know, this will go away.
Right, but, you know, when the smoke cleared and then they brought in all the scientists and the guys from NASA and said, okay, you know, find the ghost in the machine, and nobody could find it, and they're just basically saying, look, this is not a problem versus the case with...
Not a technical problem.
Right.
But what was clearly identified, because they brought in other experts to not examine the physical properties of the car and what gremlins might be in there causing the car to... They looked at the structure of Toyota and how it reacted to this or did not react to it. And the company initiated really pretty significant changes as a result of that.
Right.
And I wonder if that's not a precedent for what GM's about to go through. This is going to drag on for a couple of years. It's going to cost maybe now a couple of billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. I've been saying hundreds of millions. Maybe it's even going to be greater than that by the time it's over.
See, but does this take the bloom off the rose in terms of the new products that General Motors is, the aforementioned, full-size SUVs.
Right.
I mean, do people look at that and say,
But Gary, I got an email from a viewer this week who said, I was going to go out and shop for a Buick Regal. He says, I'm not going to any GM product right now. Now, you got to take what people tell you online with a grain of salt, and this is only one person, but... we'll see what happens.
I think it does raise that issue. It raises the issue of it brings back all of those old memories and stereotypes of old GM that they have worked hard to get beyond.
Right.
It clearly does.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And as I look at what our chat room is saying, that people are going back and forth. It's either that, this is pre-bankruptcy beating on GM still. You know, that people are still on their case. To others saying, it's like the old GM, and others are saying, Toyota's a media darling, GM is not, and this is, but I think when you have the president of General Motors North America saying, Ellen Beatty, it's, we did it, we're sorry, we're going to look into it. But to the point of communications, to get off this topic a little bit, the Simon Sproul moving from this
nice
is sort of
segue there, Gary.
I mean, but this is okay. But admittedly, this is inside baseball for us guys.
Right. Yeah.
And in terms
anybody
of this,
anybody in the media, anybody in corporate communication.
But
it's big news.
It's big news.
So Tesla went out and hired away from Nissan Renault a guy named Simon Sproul, great friend of ours. Anybody who's known him. Great car guy, really knows the business, has worked at Ford, at Jaguar. When I first met him, I think he had just got out of BMW. He's been reporting directly to Carlos Ghosn for both Nissan and Renault, and Tesla hires him.
Yeah.
Holy moly.
Right.
And I got to believe they just started laying down bills and said, and here's your stock options too, by the way, because I'll bet Simon Dunn real good moving over to Tesla.
The surprising thing that I was thinking about, and this just gets back to the whole thing of image versus perhaps substance, but in all the years I've known Simon, I've never seen him wearing anything but a tailored three-piece suit. And I have
He's a proper British gentleman.
But I've never seen an image of Elon Musk where he wasn't wearing a T-shirt.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is his...
I like where this is going, Gary.
There's all kinds of things that are like contradictory to me with Tesla. I mean, on one hand, you've got, and maybe this is an outcome of it. To me, this is Tesla saying, okay, we're serious about communicating professionally now, and maybe they always were, but this is a move that is they're going out and getting among the best in the industry, among the most experienced. They're serious about doing what they're doing, and yet we just saw them at the Detroit Auto Show with one of the weirdest, worst performances of a press conference that I've ever seen at the Detroit Auto Show. You know, just standing up, the executive was up there talking off the cuff without, you know, stammering through, hard to hear. I recorded it and went back to listen to and get a quote off of my recorder. I couldn't even hear clearly what the guy was saying. I didn't get it. It was hard to get a good quote out of it. So you've got this on one hand, Tesla being really serious about things and wanting to do things right, and yet they do things vastly differently than any other car company out there.
Which gets back to the thing I've often thought that they're not a car company in the classic sense that we think of car companies. Yeah. I think they're a technology company that happens to be making cars. And you know, over the years, I found that it is profoundly different to deal with the companies that make computers or software, and trying to get to their executives, and than it is in the auto industry. I mean, it's surprising how good we have it compared to some of our colleagues that are tech reporters
sure.
and just
absolutely
that are
yeah.
dealing with that. And so, you know, the fact that Tesla is doing it in sort of a previously a bizarro world way, I think that may speak to the nature of that company. I mean, you know, the guy's doing SpaceX, and he's got that Solar City project where he's putting solar cells into Best Buy stores, and he's got to deal with Home Depot, and, you know, they're doing that. And I think that maybe, you know, after when they were talking about, you know, the Gigafactory and where they're going to put the, you know, the giant battery manufacturing operation and, you know, what state out in the Southwest, and, you know, he's got that going. He's got
Only the ones that'll let him sell cars,
right.
not through dealer franchises. And that's where he's going to put that Gigafactory.
Well, he's obviously a very clever man in terms of saying, hey, you know, would you like our factory?
Yeah.
Well, you better, you know, make sure that we get around those
it's
dealer franchise laws.
It's only $6 billion, by the way.
But so, you know, I think that's a big difference. But now with Simon Sproul coming in, who is, you know, the classically trained automotive PR guy,
mm-hmm.
And has had, you know, more than a small amount of experience, because let's not forget the Nissan Leaf and the various Renault variants that are out there that Simon has been dealing with for
good point.
For
very good point.
You know, period of time it's been out there. So I think that he's probably had more objections raised to him than we could even think of, you know, in the next hour. And, you know, he'll deftly be able to handle these things.
Well, you know, Joe Filippi, the analyst guy, really good. I thought he had the best insight into this. He said, look, they went out and hired Simon. Why? Because he works for this boss that runs all around the world, runs two separate companies, and is crazy about electric cars. So it's not that much different for him to go work for Elon.
Right. Right.
Actually, he won't be working for Elon as much as who's running Tesla, really, operations-wise?
I think Elon is.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that guy probably never sleeps. You know, I mean, he's literally probably never sleeps. And, yeah, he's running on pure adrenaline.
Lithium power.
Yeah, there you go. That's why they're building that big factory.
That's right. Hey, why don't we take a break right now? And we got to talk about this smashed up Acura MDX that we got in the studio here. So, Ben, why don't we give a good shout out to our friends at Bridgestone and Firestone?
There's only one car company in America that's never made a single car. And while you won't find Firestone cars on any showroom floor, they're out there running better, faster, stronger, longer. No, we don't build cars. But make no mistake, Firestone is a car company. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
AutoLine offers you one of the most effective ways to get your marketing message in front of the decision makers in the global automotive industry. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
Gary's got some results from the poll from the chat room as to how GM management is handling this crisis. With
all right,
the ignition
so the Insta poll results. How did GM handle the recall? With 1 being worst and 5 being best. 35% said 1 worst. 3% said 5 best, and then we have 2 is 27, 3, 26, 4, 9. So if we take the
Instapoll, so
if you take the 4 and the 5 and you add that together, you come up with a whopping 12. And if you take the 1 and the 2 and you add them together, you come up with 62.
So 62% of our
basically
are
not very happy.
Not happy with the way GM management is handling.
Yeah,
and you got a good line there. You said.
Yeah, there was a Scott in Cleveland wrote. I just counted 18 keys on my keychain. Mazda ignition cylinders must be very sturdy.
That's pretty good. So anyway, we now have to turn to our guest in the studio, Chuck Thomas, the chief engineer for, you say it for me.
For automotive structure research.
Yeah. And we've got this crashed MDX in the studio, which I love. Now, this is one that you actually crash tested.
It is. What we have in the studio is a vehicle that we actually tested in our lab down in Raymond, Ohio. And then we took the vehicle and we disassembled it down to basically just what we call a white body and left some of the chassis and the powertrain. So you could really get a better sense of what happened to the car in the crash.
Yeah, and that's pretty wild what you just said, because, you know, we see all kinds of car cutaways at automotive shows around the world and the like, and but you've created this one by taking a complete vehicle, smashing it up, and then taking all, you took out all the seats, you took off the doors, you took off a whole bunch of stuff just so we could see how the structure crushed here.
Exactly. Like, I mean, usually after a crash, you know, because of all the exterior components, the doors, the trim, the hood, the fender fascias and those types of things, it's hard to really see what the structure did, the parts of the car that really, you know, aren't the Class A or the Class 1 surfaces. So by stripping the car down to its body, you can really get a sense of sort of how the bones of the car performed in the crash. And those are the parts of the car that, are, you know, really are the basic protection that you have. And in a car crash, I have a little bit of a prejudice because I'm a structural engineer, but really the car body is the kind of foundation that's protecting you in the crash. Things like airbags and seatbelts are critically important to protect you as well. But for those things to work, the structure has to protect and maintain the space around you during the crash.
And the crash specifically that this vehicle underwent was this new Insurance Institute for Highway Safety small offset crash.
That's right. So just recently, the Insurance Institute has introduced this new crash mode. This is a 25% overlap crash with a rigid steel barrier.
So explain what you mean by a 25% overlap.
So if you think about it, if you look at, say, the front of your car, and you think of the width of your car, say, from fender to fender, that would be 100% of your width. So from, say, the driver's side of the vehicle, if you would measure over 25% of that width, that's the area of the vehicle that actually is targeted to overlap with the barrier that you're going to impact against.
Or to put it simply, in the case of this vehicle, the left front corner.
That's right. And with a 25% overlap, for most vehicles, that it will not engage what we think of as the main crash structure. So in the front of the vehicle, there are two large rails that are on each side of the engine. And one of the main functions of these rails is to absorb energy during a crash. But in this type of crash, these rails aren't really engaged. So other parts of the structure have to sort of step up and do what that rail would normally do in a front crash.
How much of this is predicated on types of material versus the architecture of how you put these various pieces together?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, because the two are really intimately connected. Today, I've been in the automotive industry for about 22 years, and today we have materials and steels that are available to us that we just couldn't even really think about using, you know, 20 years ago. So what we're able to do when we design the architecture of the car, literally the architecture, so the shape and the design of each component is created with the type of material in mind that we're going to make it out of. So we're able to put high-strength materials where we need high-strength materials, and because of those strengths, that changes how we make the shape of the part. In areas where we want more ductility or we want more energy absorption, we actually design those structures using more ductile materials. So, you'll see more bending and more deformation in those areas. So really, the two are sort of connected together. It's hard to separate the two because literally the type of material that you use determines the type of shape part you can make. Some very high tensile strength steels can't easily be formed. So those are the types of materials that might be used, say, for a bent part or a roll formed part. where some of the more advanced high-strength steels that are hot-formed can have much deeper draws than you could even have with traditionally cold-stamped steel. So
we're in an era where automakers are trying to take weight out of cars in order to improve fuel efficiency. How much weight does it add to design a car to withstand this test, and what about cost?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you mentioned that the MDX, this white body for the 2014 MDX, is actually 125 pounds lighter than the previous MDX white body. So I think, you know, there is this perception that, you know, safety has a weight penalty.
But it will have a cost penalty, because when you start talking about boron-impregnated hot-strength steel, it's not the cold-rolled stuff.
That's true. There are costs associated with materials. But a lot of the materials, actually, the cost of the material is not much of an increase, believe it or not.
Because you can use less of it?
You can use less of it. And really, what for many of these steels, the processing and the forming is not as different as you would think. So, you know, going from, say, a tensile-strength steel in the kind of the old days, it maybe had, say, 250 or 300 megapascals, up to steels that are still cold-formed, up to almost 900 megapascals, the cost difference is not so high. There is some cost associated with the investment, because the tools that are necessary to form these types of parts, you know, have to be stronger. They're more difficult to manufacture. But really, when you amortize that cost into the vehicle, it really actually turns out to be relatively small.
And then one's got to believe that in terms of the consumer, that if it passes the IIHS requirements, that your insurance rate would be somewhat lower. So even if you had to pay a premium to get the safer car, you might...
Is that true? Will this MDX, or does this MDX have a lower insurance premium?
I'm really not sure how it's going to work out. I mean, how the insurance industry really comes up with those premiums, it's hard for me to answer. But what I am pretty confident with this MDX is what we're going to see is over the life of this vehicle, it's going to perform better than any vehicle we've ever made. So from a point of view of the crash outcomes of this vehicle, we expect it to really be outstanding.
Chuck, did you come up with clever ideas and not just material substitution to get this lighter weight body in white?
Yeah, you know, there's a really interesting history when you think about what we've done to design this car. You know, Honda's been interested in kind of non-traditional crashes for a long time. We've been doing research for several years into the problems of compatibility in the fleet. I heard you guys talking a little earlier about some of the large, like, full-size SUV products. And, you know, when those vehicles first started showing up in the fleet, you know, Honda began studying the types of crashes that occur between large vehicles and small vehicles, because, you know, our vehicles have a tendency to be a little bit smaller. And we were concerned about how these compatibility outcomes could affect, you know, our vehicles. So we began doing research into how to make smaller vehicles more compatible with larger vehicles, and at the same time, how to make larger vehicles designed such that they interact in a more favorable way with small vehicles. And from that, we came up with this idea we call ACE, which is Advanced Compatibility Engineered Bodies. And when we introduced that in 2005, that was our first kind of step along this idea of these types of crashes. And then when we were developing the 2014 MDX early in its platform development, and we saw some of the work the Insurance Institute was doing, looking at these types of small overlap crashes that were occurring in the field. And one thing that's nice about the Insurance Institute, they have access to a lot of data that we don't have, because they have the insurance industry's data. So they were identifying these types of crashes, and we were kind of interested because there was a lot of overlap between what we were doing for the new MDX and what they had found. And so by studying their results, we were able to sort of adapt the structures that we already had. So, you know, things like large upper members and extended outboard structures in the front of the vehicle were really the same kind of solution that we were looking at that they were looking at.
See, and kudos to you guys, because you're way ahead of the rest of the industry on this one. I would say maybe Subaru and Volvo are sort of in being able to meet these small offset crashes, but I'm so impressed that Honda is so far ahead of everybody else. And I almost thought you guys were in collusion with the Insurance Institute, that you were so far ahead of everyone.
No collusion. But, you know, the Insurance Institute is an organization that publishes a lot of their research. You know, when we first really heard them speak publicly about this was back in 2009 in Germany at the ESV conference there. And they had published several papers looking at this small overlap phenomena. And that's when we first realized that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, overlap between what we were looking at and what they were looking at. And I've made a lot of trips down.
Overlap of the overlap.
Overlap of the overlap. because, you know, we're really all looking at the same problem. You know, even today in the fleet, with all the improvements we've made in automotive safety, You know, we're still looking at around 32,000 traffic fatalities each year in the United States. So, you know, every automaker and groups like the insurance industry are constantly looking for, you know, where are the areas we can continue to improve in the performance of the vehicle.
You know, it's interesting, you know, you're saying that they're so far ahead. And as he mentioned, I think this is really important to point out that you guys have been doing this for a long time. I went and looked back to see, you know, when Honda started talking about the ACE body structure. And so this goes back to the beginning of 2005. And so they're basically saying, blah, 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 the ACE body structure offering enhanced occupant protection while at the same time increasing compatibility with other vehicles will be applied to all new vehicle platforms in the U.S. and globally over the next 6 to 7 years. The 2005 model Honda Odyssey minivan and Acura RL sedan are the first models to carry this technology. So, I mean, these guys have been working it for a very long time. It's not like they thought, this would be a good idea to maybe do now. So,
I've also, as gushing I have been in what I just said about Honda, you know, have been astounded to see everybody else caught with their pants down. This is the only area where I fault the Insurance Institute is, I think it's a totally legitimate test, but to start testing knowing that no one ever designed for this, or so many never designed for it, I think is unfair. I think you should give plenty of warning. You should give at least one design cycle warning saying this is what's coming, because I think they could have affected faster change doing it that way throughout the industry.
How long do you think it'll take the industry to catch up and adapt to the test and have cars on the road that meets it?
Well, I think that for most vehicles, to make the kind of changes we made to the MDX really requires a full model change redesign cycle. We have made changes to vehicles mid-cycle, the 2014 Honda Odyssey, we did a mid-cycle redesign on to improve its performance in this type of crash. And you can do it. The biggest problem you're going to run into is in that mid-cycle redesign, there is a weight penalty. Because without being able to sort of like, you know, rebuild the entire architecture of the vehicle to be more efficient, the only way you can really do that is by adding additional components and additional structure. So, you know, it's probably going to take, I would imagine, for the whole fleet at least like several years before everything can sort of be redesigned.
Yeah.
So the mid-cycle will be like belt and suspenders, but if you design it from the beginning, it's one or the other?
That may be a good way to put it, yeah.
So Chip's over there with the camera. What I'd like to do is point out for the audience here some of the specifics of what you had to change in this front-end design to be able to meet this small offset. So I don't know if you can see the screen there well enough, but Ben will bring it up. But so for everybody watching right now, let's just look at what's on the screen, the left-hand side of the vehicle, and you see this big orange thing coming out of the base of the A-pillar and the cowl of the vehicle, running down all the way to the bumper beam.
That's right. So,
and I've never seen anything like that on a car before.
Right. It's a little novel. It's actually something that came out of the original ACE work that we did. And this is the part we call the upper member. Traditionally, this part is very small because it would really only support the fender. But what we did is we extended it all the way down to the bumper beam to do two things, effectively. One is it helps support the bumper beam because our bumper beam is extended in this type of design.
And let's go back to that shot of... the bumper beam, of course, if you're looking at the screen, is at the very bottom of the screen. It just looks like a big extrusion or stamping.
That's the uncrunched one that we can see there on the side.
And so usually the front members are what's commonly called the shotguns. The bumper beam is only as wide as they are. And when you're saying extended, this bumper beam goes out beyond the shotguns.
Right. So what we wanted to do is in this type of crash, we want to be able to engage the vehicle that you're going to impact against or the structure you're going to impact against or whatever you might hit in these type of small overlap phenomena. So the first thing we need structure in the forward corner of the car that's there to begin the engagement early in the event. Because literally in a crash, every millisecond counts for a lot. So the earlier we can engage whatever you're impacting, the more time we have to absorb crash energy before the what we call the crash interface reaches the cabin where the occupant is. So by using the bumper beam and some other structures in the lower bulkhead and even structures in the subframe that help support the chassis, we can develop early engagement in your crash partner's situation. That quickly allows us to begin to load up the structure and begin to absorb that energy early on.
So what you're really doing is just tying everything together, really?
Right.
You got braces and you know, members going this way and that, just to tie the whole structure together.
Right. We want to have something that's outboard of the front side frame that's there to interact with in this type of crash. We just don't want empty air up there. We need a structure up there. But then we also need something to support that structure and something that can absorb energy during the crash as we move through the engine compartment. Because normally we would use the side frame, but in these types of crashes, the side frame is not very engaged. So one of the things you see, that large orange sort of trunk-type shape, is that upper member. And that structure actually absorbs a lot of the energy as it's crushed. And if you look at, say, the other side of the vehicle where it is crushed, you can see how deformed it is after the crash.
Yeah, yeah. And we've got that shot up on the screen right now. I mean, it's just smashed.
but so you're taking the energy in. I mean, the energy doesn't go away. I mean, you hit something, there's some law of thermodynamics, I'm sure, that says it isn't going away. So what you'd want to do is direct it into areas that will keep the people who are within the vehicle safe. So it's not like you just have a big stiff thing that you're ramming against a...
Exactly. I mean, like we talked about earlier, you know, part of the idea with material selection is what do we want that particular part to do during a crash? And components in the engine compartment, forward of the occupant space, we want those parts to actually deform during the crash because that deformation absorbs that crash energy. So the work that's done by deforming those parts takes energy, and that energy is taken out of the crash situation.
Right.
So by absorbing that energy, it reduces the velocity of the car and reduces the energy that we have to manage when the crash event sort of reaches the occupant space.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then once we kind of move through the engine compartment, what's left is, you know, the occupant space. So eventually the crash interface reaches where the occupant is.
Mm-hmm.
And what we want to have happen in this type of crash is we want to maintain the integrity of that occupant space because there's a lot of energy left. This crash is very severe. It's run at 40 miles an hour. So there's a lot of kinetic energy, especially for a large vehicle like the MDX. So when that crash interface reaches the cabin, we need to have the cabin be strong enough to withstand whatever force is left without deforming. So what we've done with the MDX is where we use the highest strength steels, these really high strength hot stamp parts. And particularly the MDX has a ring, one piece of steel ring that forms the ring around the driver's door. And that structure provides a tremendous amount of strength. So when the crash interface and the chassis and everything else that's been driven back into the cabin reaches that area actually doesn't deform. And what that does is it produces a high force against the vehicle cabin. And that high force makes the cabin begin to rotate. So I didn't really bring any videos with me, but your audience can find plenty of them on YouTube on the channel the Insurance Institute runs there, and you can see these kind of crashes. And what will happen is these vehicles like the MDX, when the crash interface reaches the cabin, you'll see the vehicle begin to yaw very quickly. And that yawing is important because what that's doing is it's carrying that remaining energy away as kinetic energy, and it's dissipating that energy as the vehicle turns. Because we want to remove that energy from the equation. We don't want you to have to experience that energy in the crash.
And as you mentioned before the show began, one of the things that people may notice that there is a rear tire, but there's no front tire, that the wheel explodes due to the impact, and that despite all of that damage that we can see there, that the door actually opened on that.
Yeah, this door, you're right. So during the crash, the chassis is literally crushed. The wheel is crushed into pieces. In the MDX, actually, the brake rotor itself is broken into pieces. It's just compressed against the white body. However, that ring actually reacts all that force and protects that occupant space. And after this test, not only did the door open, which makes it pretty easy to get the crash dummy out of the test, the door closes again. So maybe the gap tolerances may have been tweaked a little bit, so I don't know if it would have meet the quality assurance.
So it wouldn't go through a car wash without getting water inside.
Yeah, you know, still, I mean, it's just open and close. Yeah. That's pretty impressive.
It opens and closes because, you know, I mean, that's important. Maintaining that occupant space is really critical to help trying to protect the occupant because what we're trying to do is not only are we trying to prevent them from, you know, intrusion injuries where the structure sort of collapses around you and injures you, but also is these other key protective devices like the airbags and the seatbelts are connected to the body. So if the body collapses or the body deforms around you, these devices move, and they're not really intended to move. So if the airbag moves towards you or towards the center of the car, it reduces the effectiveness of that airbag. If the area of the door is heavily deformed, the door can actually open or come off. And, of course, that poses a real serious risk to an occupant.
Hey, this is probably a good time to get into all the questions that are coming in from the audience. And so we're going to go back to calling this the rapid fire segment. And Ben, let's let that rip. Okay, Chuck, HTG, you touched on this a little bit, but he wants to know, how much do the wheel and tire contribute to absorbing the energy of this offset crash?
In this vehicle, I mean, I couldn't tell you exactly how many joules. It depends a little bit on the type of wheel. So, for example, an aluminum wheel is going to break and it's going to crack. And that type of deformation actually absorbs less energy than you would with a steel wheel, where the steel actually bends and deforms. But, I mean, it is a significant part of what we're trying to do in the crash.
Amelia Fun says, what if you made a boat tail nose on the car so it would deflect off of accidents?
Well, you know, the problem with that is that might work if you, say, run this crash test. But in the real world, you know, the angles and the vectors that vehicles interact with aren't pre-described like you would have in a laboratory. So it's important we design the structure. We can't design this structure to function in just like one type of crash. We have to think about all the types of configurations you might run into in the real world.
But wouldn't a bullet nose or a pointier nose maybe accommodate a whole lot of accidents?
Well, it might.
Pedestrian safety.
but you could imagine.
Not that pointy.
You can imagine the situation where the vehicle that you strike may come in at sort of an angle to you. So it may actually hit normal to that boat shape. Mm-hmm. So then how strong that boat shape is, you know, really makes a difference.
Yeah. He also wants to know, how hopeful are you that autonomous vehicles could greatly mitigate fatalities?
We're really hopeful. You know, it's I work in injury mitigation and structures, and I often say I'm one of the few guys at Honda that really look forward to going out of business. You know, we hope that in the future that active safety technologies are going to have a big impact on reducing crashes overall. And if you don't crash, then the stuff that I work on doesn't really have much of a function. But I think it's exciting because today we're really beginning to see the potentials of these types of accident avoidance technologies. You know, we've started introducing them into some of our vehicles and so have many of our competitors, and we're really looking forward to see the effect that they're going to have over the next several years.
BR says, now that front ends are going to be stiffer to pass the small offset, are we going to see a resurgence of injuries that were more common before the advent of crumple zones?
I don't think so, because the thing is, the front end is not necessarily stiffer, because what we do is we balance the stiffness in the front end. So while we add structures, say, like in the outer areas, like that upper member, what we also do is we design the side frame not to be extra stiff. So we're just kind of distributing the stiffness
right,
over a larger area.
Right, you're channeling the energies, so it's not...
Exactly, yeah.
How much of this did you design by testing and smashing things against a wall, and how much did you design by just using computer analysis?
Most of what we've done with this vehicle was actually designed through computer modeling or computer engineering. For years, I was a computer analyst, and I did a lot of structural modeling. And those tools today are incredibly powerful. We really couldn't design vehicles like this without the computer modeling that we have available to us, because you just can't go through that many iteration cycles. Literally, you know, we can run hundreds of simulations to look at different material combinations, different construction with a computer model. That, you know, maybe if you do prototype testing, you know, you can only build a few vehicles to really evaluate. And much of what you see in these types of structures, especially with these types of materials, is sometimes very counterintuitive. So, you know, even as an experienced engineer, what you might think would work, you know, often doesn't really work as well as you would hope it would. Hmm. And the computer is very objective. I mean, it just, you know, helps you understand what's really going on.
JM1NB wants to know, what competitor car have you taken apart and learned something novel from?
That's an interesting question. I actually don't get a chance to take very many cars apart because, you know, when I finish with them, they're not worth very much. So people don't like to give me the, you know, expensive cars like you guys get to drive. You know, I think that, you know, you know, that is a really difficult question. For what we've done in this situation, I can't really think of anybody that we really looked at carefully. You know, I think in a lot of ways we were kind of pretty far ahead with what we already done with compatibility. But there are some interesting ideas out there. I mean, you know, many of the European companies, I think, have been very active in the development of these high-strength materials. And, you know, I think that's definitely something that we looked at to see, you know, what was available from a strength of materials that we could try to integrate into our structures. But when it comes to the architecture, there's not very much architecture out of the MDX that's based on anything else.
Is this applicable to sedans? So will this have an effect on a Civic?
It will, and it already has.
The Accord meets this test.
The Accord earned a good rating. The Civic actually earned a good rating. And the technology that we have developed and integrated into the MDX has been reflected into those vehicles as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as quickly as we can, we're reflecting it into our entire fleet.
We got a whole bunch of questions or comments coming in about the GM ignition switch. Alex Norwood says, I can't be the only person out here who thinks GM should not be responsible for any of these people's problems with 437 keys hanging off the keychain. Where does it stop? What if I want to hang a bowling ball off mine? Put me in that jury pool. P.S., stop hating my Chevy Volt.
Doesn't it have a push-button start? No key ring.
The Volt.
Here's another Schmedzel. I think you said something about him. He wants to know, is it possible that the old boys network at GM put Mary Barra in place to struggle with a no-win situation?
Wow.
Yeah.
There's lots of conspiracy theories.
There's some conspiracy theories on that one, all right. It looks like we got a phone call on this one coming in, too. Ben, let's bring that in.
Yeah, this is Cleb Zarofsky from Delmont, Pennsylvania. I've been driving for over 60 years, and I've had a car a couple of times. The engine quit running, driving down the road, and all you do is bump it into neutral and coast off to the side of the road. I just don't understand how these people get involved in accidents, that people get killed when this happens. I enjoy your program very much, and I follow it all the time. Thank you.
I understand what he's saying is he's just saying, well, put the car in neutral and coast to the side of the road. And that's great if you're just going in a straight line. What if you're cornering, trying to cut in front of that truck, you know, where you think you have enough space and room, and boom, the thing conks out? What if you're on a turn? I understand what he's saying. In some situations, I think it's easy enough, but in others, it's not going to be that easy to deal with.
Or in very heavy traffic, rush hour traffic. You can't just slow down. The guy in back of you might run into you.
Yeah.
And having just driven in Georgia in an ice storm, totally different kind of a situation. But I observed people that don't know how to. I mean, for better or worse, they have no idea how to drive in snow. And any time their car slid just a little bit, their brake lights lit up. I mean, they slammed on the brakes, which of course is
the worst thing to do.
Worst thing to do. You had to do an extra level of defensive driving to survive down there through that.
VRM Chris Gary heard you talking about the A3 earlier, and he says, why buy the A3 when the A4 is similar in price when comparably equipped?
Well, my point of view on that would be it's a different car. It's a smaller car. You'd be looking for something different. And I think if you're looking at it in terms of size, I mean, the A4 is bigger than the A3. And the A3 is new. I mean, it's like, why not buy the new one? That's what I would do, I mean, if I were buying a car.
And finally, Glenn Strauss says, you know, we've been reporting Uwe Ellinghaus, the new CMO at Cadillac, has said maybe it's time to get away from this alphabet soup of the way that we name cars. So Glenn says, I, for one, think that Cadillac names are the way it should be. Just like the European car companies, you pretty much can tell the order or the hierarchy in the brand with what there is now. I would hate to see some of those old names come back. Isn't Cadillac trying to move away from the perception of its cars being for an older clientele?
So I wrote a review this week of the ELR, and I had an email that came in and said, what does ELR stand for? I don't know. So my only response was, what does Escalade mean?
Right. I don't know. I think it'd be good to get... I don't think there's a... there's ATS, CTS, okay, DTS. No,
that's
XLR.
SRX. SRX.
Yeah. What's the big sedan? XLR.
XTS.
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 See, it's too hard. It's just...
Let's
not start talking about Lincoln or any of the others, because then they all get jumbled.
Or Acura.
Yeah. Yeah. Chuck's not here to talk about that.
Right.
But anyway, we've run out of questions for rapid fire. It's probably as good a time to wrap it up here. Or do you have anything from the chat room there?
You pretty much hit the high points here. There was one that was, I thought, was... Amelia Fun wrote something about having an Accord in a crash at 55 miles an hour and only had to replace three pieces that they could wrench off and buy the parts on eBay. So
wow. It
was, I think that was interesting.
That's pretty good.
Let me confirm that. Yeah, Emil, you found I just had a 96 Accord wreck at 55 miles an hour, only had to wrench off three parts, total of $150 worth of eBay parts. So,
of course, his 55-mile-an-hour accident is nothing like a 40-mile-an-hour impact into an immovable object.
That's true, yeah. I mean,
there'd be more than $150 worth of parts on that.
Yeah,
I've always been told that hitting an immovable object at whatever speed is like hitting another parked car at double that speed.
That's about right.
So a 40-mile-an-hour barrier impact is like smashing into another parked car at 80 miles an hour. Mm.
Yeah, if that car was your weight. Right?
Because a lot of people think 40, what's the big deal? 40's not that big a speed, but it'll send a chill down your spine to hear the impact.
Yeah, we in our laboratory in Ohio, we often have visitors and we'll run tests for them. And it's really interesting to see the different responses that people have never really been up and close to see an actual car crash. And the two things that happen, I hear from people, is the first thing is when the car comes into the lab at, say, 40 or 35 miles an hour, it seems like it's not going very fast. And then, about 75 feet from the entrance to the lab to the barrier, it hits the barrier, and then people are just shocked by the sound.
Yeah.
The combination of the noise you hear from the structure impact against the barrier, as well as the, airbags deploying and other things happening, is really a little, blood-curdling.
Disconcerting.
I don't know how you can do it. I mean, I see these things and I want to walk home. Just I don't care if it's 25 miles, I'll just walk.
We do a bring your kid to work day every year, and we always do a crash for the kids. And on many occasions, I've had kids start crying, being scared, being frightened. I certainly don't want to frighten them, but we certainly want to impress on them, the importance of automotive safety, even when you're just Wear your seatbelt. Always wear your seatbelt.
Chuck, thanks so much for coming on the show, and especially bringing your smashed up MDX with you.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it was great to be here. You guys, if you're ever down in Raymond, Ohio, just stop by, and we'll show you around.
You'll rustle up a crash test for
we'll
us.
We'll find something. Yeah, there's a parking lot full of cars out there. So.
And Brent Snavely, great seeing you, man, and
great
thanks
to see
for
you.
All your input.
Yeah,
really good stuff.
Great to be on the show.
Gary, great being with you.
Let's
do it again next week.
Okay, we'll do that.
Real good. I want to remind everybody, you can listen on your daily commute to all the great Autoline products via Bluetooth in your car, or even if you don't have that, all you need is an aux jack for your stereo. And, of course, you can subscribe to us on your smartphone via Stitcher, the Apple Podcast app, or by visiting autoline.tv just to have you think about us even more conveniently than before. Thanks, y'all, for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.